2 Samuel chapter 19. As we continue to look at the Bible from Genesis to Revelation on Sunday nights, David has survived the rebellion of his son Absalom, and Absalom has died at the hands of Joab. And it's taken the tribe of Judah and some of the tribes of Israel a little while to invite David back to take his place as king over the nation. And just because Absalom had rebelled against him didn't mean that he didn't still have that position by God. And so he comes back and crosses over the River Jordan, returns to Jerusalem, and continues in that call of God upon his life as king. And there we find ourselves in chapter 20, verse 1. There happened to be there a rebel, and literally a man of Belial, a man of really a man of the devil. You know, we don't look at rebellion in those terms so much anymore. It's so common around us that we're the proverbial frog being boiled slowly, so that we don't even recognize what is not a virtue and what is not only not a virtue, but what is a danger, not only to an individual, but a danger to a nation. And you can't have a whole nation of rebels, and sometimes you have just one rebel can cause you a lot of problems. And so this man's going to pick a very strategic time to rebel against David. David is returning to his office as king following the rebellion of his son. Again, it's a work of God. And yet this guy and this type of guy chooses his opportunities carefully. And he realizes it's not going to be very long before David once again has that position of strength and power and authority again, and he won't have a chance like right now to rebel against David. There's nothing wrong with David. It's something wrong in this man's heart. And so he comes to rebel against David, and his name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. That was Saul's tribe. And he blew a trumpet and he said, "We have no part in David, nor have we do we have an inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." And so he calls the northern tribes to join him in his rebellion against David. And so every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem remained loyal to their king. And so now David has another rebellion on his hands. But it's not a son that's rebelling against him. He's thinking a little more clearly this time. He recognizes the danger a little more quickly, and he's going to use his authority a little more swiftly. This rebellion, he's not going to give any room to. And it's not so much that David is threatened by Sheba any more than, you know, he was threatened by Shimei and his throwing of rocks and dust and dirt clods at him. One of his officers said, "Let me go over and take his head off, you know, for what he did to us." And David said, "Listen, don't I know that I'm the king? I mean, I don't have to get into some kind of a session here where people can affirm me in my position. I know I'm the king. I don't need to take people's heads off to feel good about the fact that I can be king and exercise my authority." But he's going to come down really heavy on this guy because he doesn't want another 20,000 young men of Israel to be caught in another crossfire of a man's pride and a man's bitterness. This guy's operating under the same influences of Ahithophel and Absalom. He's bitter against David. He's proud. He's rebellious. He's self-seeking. And David says, "I'm not going to see another 20,000 young men of Israel dead on a battlefield because one guy wants to, you know, take me on in a barroom brawl." And so he just, where'd that come from? But anyway, so David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women who had been left behind and Absalom had lain with, his concubines who he had left to keep the house, and he put them in seclusion, supported them the rest of their lives, but he didn't go into them in a physical relationship, and they were shut up to the day of their death, not like put in a closet or anything. They just were not in the middle of things, living in widowhood. So he supported them, but they had been shamed, and so he supported them to their death, no fault of their own. And then the king said to Amasa, "Assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and present and be present here yourself." You remember now, Amasa had become the general over the armies of David, and David had said, "Listen, let's be united together, and Amasa, I'll give you the position of general over the armies, and relieve Joab of that position and give that position to you." So Amasa is, you know, his five-star general. He's the commander-in-chief, really, related to the armies. And he tells them, "Gather the men of Judah for battle here within 3 days and present and be present here yourself." And so Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time, the 3 days which David had appointed him. Now, David had told him to take 3 days to gather this army, and there was a reason for it. This was a big danger. This was a danger to the nation. And every hour that went by meant the possibility of more innocent bloodshed. So he told this guy, "I need you here in 3 days with the army. Be there." And this guy snoozes. He's not going to be there. Ever seen that license plate that says, "Always late, but worth the wait"? Well, Amasa should have got one for his chariot, but he because David didn't think he was worth the wait. And sometimes, you know, being late related to what we're supposed to be doing will get us into some troubles, or we'll find ourselves replaced. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us." This guy's going to get a stronghold. Let's go after him right now. And I don't know what's happened to Amasa, but you go ahead and take care of business here. And Amasa misses a great opportunity to be used of the Lord here. And so Joab's men with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and all the mighty men, the 600 men that had been with David from the very beginning, went out after him, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. I hope this guy's good, because these 600 men that are coming after him, you wouldn't want to meet them. These guys were rough customers. They were men of war. They'd been through a lot with David. They were valiant men. They were godly men. And David puts these guys on his trail. And when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, now Amasa, the man that replaced him, the general that was late, comes forward now. And as Joab's going forward to meet him, his sword falls out. And then Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother?" And they were related, because they were, both of them were nephews of David, but through distant kind of family relations. And so, "Are you in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground, and Joab did not strike him again. There was no need to, and thus he died. And then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." But Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway, and when the man saw that all of the people stood still, he moved Amasa from the highway to the field, threw a garment over him, and when he saw that everyone who came upon him halted. So here's just a cold-blooded murder. And they murder him, and then they say, "Everyone who's with Joab, everyone who's with David." Now this is trying to sanctify your name through association. David doesn't have anything to do with this. "Come on, let's go and be with Joab." And he thought everyone would say, "All right, good, Amasa's dead, let's follow Joab." They shouldn't have replaced Joab anyway with Amasa. But as the men came up on the scene of this man dead in the middle of the road, Joab and his brother realized that the support for them wasn't that strong. And that you can get that way in politics, and this is a political scene that's happening right here, and they just assume that everyone's going to run to their side, and they forget that even the men in their army have a limit of what's acceptable to them. And they looked at this scene, and they were disgusted by it. And what Joab had done was forcing them to make a choice on whether this was acceptable to them and what Joab had done. And they're clearly appalled by it, even these men of war. And so the whole progression comes to a stop. And so they take the body and they throw it off to the side and throw a garment over it. And none of this is right. This is just an account. And this is not what God wants to have happen, but it's an account of what did happen. And when he was removed from the highway, all of the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. So here's these 600 men. They know war. They know what's fair as it relates to war. They know what's necessary as it relates to war. But this was not a part of their deal. They weren't into this. And he went through all of the tribes of Israel, Joab did, to Abel and Beth-Makah and to all the Barites. And so they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. So they're gathering now quite an army to follow after Sheba. Sheba has, they assume, is gathering quite an army to himself as it relates to the northern kingdoms of tribes of Israel. And then they came and they besieged him in Abel of Beth-Makah. And they cast up a siege mound against the city and stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. And here are these soldiers, and all they know is fighting. And this guy goes into this city, and he closes up the wall behind him, and now these soldiers are going to break down the wall of the city and destroy the city to get to one man. And a wise woman's going to come out and going to ask them what in the world they're doing here. Because it doesn't make any sense. Sometimes we have to be careful. We go into automatic pilot on some of our tendencies, and that's what they do as a soldier here. They're just going to go in and say, oh, this always gets taken care of with brute force. Let's just destroy the thing and shred everyone and find our guy and then go home. But that's not what ought to happen here. That's not what needs to happen at all. And far better to deal with it a little more delicately, as we're going to see. You know, Sheba is a coward. All he's done is he's gone into a city and he's going to make the people of that city a human shield for him. Just like the terrorists today. They're just cowards. It's very frustrating to deal with them. And yet it's a methodology, a method of warfare that's very effective and very effective for the powerless. So that's why it's used. It's very effective. But it's very cowardly to put men, innocent men, women, and children in between you and your enemy because you won't face your enemy man to man. And that's part of the frustration of so much of the terrorism that goes on today. They're just cowards, the way that they do these things. Well, it's as old as man's history. That's what this guy is doing. He's putting human shields between him and the force that he knows is coming against him. And then there was a wise woman. Oh, you know, praise the Lord for a city that has one wise woman in it. I mean, this city's going to be thankful for a wise woman. And there's more than just her there, as we're going to see. And then a wise woman cried out from the city. And she said, "Hear, hear." That's just a bit of an English background in her. "Please say to Joab, come nearby that I may speak to you." In other words, time out. Can we talk about this? Do you have to destroy the whole city? I mean, can we talk about this? That's what she wants to do. She just wants to talk about what's going on to Joab. When Joab had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." And then she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I am listening." And then she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times." There's a funny thing we used to do at times like this in the past. I know it's kooky, I know it's crazy, but we used to talk these kinds of things through before. We didn't just destroy cities without talking about it. We didn't just destroy innocent lives without talking about what was going on. They used to talk in former times. It was a novel idea, saying, "They shall surely ask counsel at Abel." And so apparently this very city that they're in, it was known for coming together to talk and to receive counsel. And so, and I love that word so, and what does it refer to? Talking. By talking, they would end disputes. There's an idea for you. That's a great idea. And here is a woman, and she says, "I am among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" Here we are, the blessed are the peacemakers, right? And she's talking some sense, isn't she? She's talking a lot of sense. She's going to save this whole city from being destroyed and innocent blood being on the hand of these men. How many of us here tonight, and don't shout out, but just as we allow the lesson of the passage to search our hearts, how many of us could be in this room tonight and tomorrow you are armed for war, or later tonight, and whether it be a marriage or whether it be a business, whether it be a relationship, whatever it might be, and you are ready to go to war related to that, and you haven't even talked it over with the person, haven't even talked about it. So important that before a war develops, to make sure that if it doesn't need to happen, that it doesn't happen. And the importance of just communicating. And you can look at the relationships that we have in our lives, maybe a marriage relationship tonight, and you can look and you're about to go to war on one another, and you look and you say, you know, there was a day where we used to talk about this kind of stuff. We didn't used to handle things this way. And let's go back to that day and let's talk about things. Let's talk about what's going on here. Let's talk about what the problem is. And sometimes the problem is entirely different from what we think it is. And sometimes the solution is very easy once everybody puts their AK-47s down or puts down their bazookas or puts down their slingshots or whatever it might be. And so Joab said, "Far be it from me, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not so, but a man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city." The whole thing is over one issue. It's over one man, one thing. If that can get solved, then there's no need for a huge war to occur. And so deliver him, and I'll depart from the city. And the woman said to Joab, "Watch, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." She goes in. All illustrations break down somewhere, so you got to be careful here. So she goes in. What does she do? She holds a special election. She goes in her wisdom, went to all of the people, and they counted the ballots and said, "Listen, do you want to die and your children for this rebel, or should we just take his head off and throw it over the wall?" It was a landslide. And so they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, threw it over the wall out to Joab. Thump, thump, I mean, you just see it. I can. And then he blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. And so Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem. And so that was who they had come out to get, and that's the head that they got. And so a wise woman that said, "Let's talk about it," kept something from becoming far bigger than it needed to be. Communication is very, very important. And Joab was over all of the army of Israel. This is David's cabinet. He was the commander-in-chief. This man was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Adoram was in charge of the revenue, so they did have the tax collectors even back then. Jehoshaphat was the recorder. Sheba was the scribe. Zadok and Abiathar were the priests, and Ira was a chief minister under David. Now, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. In other words, 1 year after another, and David inquired of the Lord. So, you know, the Lord, there's a problem that the Lord has with the children of Israel at this particular point in time. He wants to get their attention, and so he sends famine. And they didn't understand that the famine was of the Lord the first year or the second year, but they picked it up the third year. Sometimes it takes about that long, doesn't it, for there to be an understanding that, hey, maybe God is in this famine, and we ought to seek his face related to what's happening. And God was in this famine, and God was trying to get the attention of his people through the famine. But it took 3 years, but he's finally inquired of. David inquires of the Lord, and the Lord answered and said, the famine is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites. And so the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites are not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn protection to them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. The Gibeonites, you may remember, were the tribe or the group of people that had deceived Joshua and the children of Israel when they came into the land. They knew they were the next group of people to be conquered by the children of Israel, and so they brought their bread with mold on it and their sandals with holes in it, and they said the bread was fresh out of the oven when we left, and our shoes were brand new, and look how old they are. We come from a far land. And they had deceived and made the children of Israel and had entered into a covenant with them. And the covenant was that the children of Israel would not destroy the Gibeonites. And Saul, that had always been honored by the children of Israel towards the Gibeonites. They had stuck with their word. And when Saul became king, and we have no record of it in Scripture, he attempts to utterly destroy the Gibeonites. Somewhere along the line, he attempted to annihilate them. And we don't know any more than what his motive was there at the end of verse 2. He had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. And God is upset over the shedding of innocent blood in his nation and among people. And again, this is a time just to stop for a moment and allow my heart to be impacted by the Word of God, because we're so used to bloodshed. There's blood everywhere. There's blood in the newspaper. There's blood on the news. There's innocent blood being shed in every city in the United States. And we forget that God brought judgment on entire nations for the killing of one innocent man or one innocent woman. It's a heavy thing for an individual life to head into eternity. It's always a heavy thing when they have lived out there 70 and head into eternity by a natural means. There's nothing heavier than heading into eternity, and God knows that. And it's a terrible thing for a nation to be known for the shedding of innocent blood, and he holds a nation responsible for it. I hate to think about what is built up as it relates to our nation, the stench that it is in God's nostrils, simply because of the death of innocent people, the amount of bloodshed that occurs within our nation. But the Lord was upset about it, and he was going to deal with it. And it had happened years earlier, but he was still upset with it, and he wanted to make sure that this zeal of Saul in an attempt to kill the Gibeonites was addressed. Why would Saul do this? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense if you think about it outwardly. And yet here we're told that he did it for the zeal, in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. He didn't need to do that. Didn't need to do it. He didn't need to do that to prove that he was a godly man. He wasn't a godly man. He didn't need to do that to prove that, he was a true Israelite. Didn't need to do it. God didn't want that. God had not put him in a position of authority in order that he would destroy people who were different from him. You and I must be careful of this as Christians. When the Lord puts us in positions of authority, he puts us there to be righteous in that position. And you will take all kinds of, talk and persecution when you make a stand for righteousness' sake. But it is never to slaughter someone in the name of the Lord. however that slaughter might take place. And so here is a man who abuses his power, and in doing so, he misrepresents the Lord. Sometimes you see Christians who somehow feel compelled to do extraordinary things, and I mean extraordinary in a bad way, in order to prove that they're a real Christian. And, you know, to get their stripes. And you look at it sometimes and you look right below the surface and you go, is there a zeal for the Lord in that? Does the Lord have anything to do with that? Or is that a zeal or a pressure that that person feels related to the people of God but has no origin in God? You have to be careful of that. You have to be careful of that kind of a thing. And so he enters in and attempts to destroy these people. And therefore David said to the Gibeonites, verse 3, what shall I do for you? And with what shall I make atonement, or literally cover up for this sin that's been sinned against you, that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And here's something that a Saul can never understand and didn't understand. David understood it, and that is, what can we do that will allow you to bless the inheritance of the Lord? What can we do that will cause you to, from this point forward, look at God's people and see them not as an enemy, but see them as a blessing? And David understood that the misrepresentation by Saul had a consequence, and it caused an entire group of people to look at God's people as the enemy rather than as a blessing. And that's what David wanted to have restored, and that's what God wanted to have restored. And the Gibeonites said to him, we will have no silver or gold from Saul or from his house. And that was a common way to make restitution for the death of others. We don't want any money from him, nor shall you kill any man in Israel. We don't want you killing innocent people of the tribe of Israel. They're being very selective here. Very, very careful. They're not wanting innocent blood to be shed related to what happened to them. And he said, whatever you say, that I will do for you. And so they answered David the king, as the man who consumed us and plotted against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the territories of Israel, let 7 men of his descendants be delivered to us. We will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord chose. And the king said, I will give them. But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. And so the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, the 2 sons of Rizpah, and whom she bore to Saul as a concubine, and the 5 sons of Michal, it says there. Actually, it's Merib, we know from 1 Samuel chapter 18, that she was the wife of Adriel, and so it should be Merib. It might be an error on the part of a scribe, and he's thinking of the daughters of Saul and puts that in there, Michal instead of Merib. There are some who believe that perhaps Merib died and that Michal became kind of a foster mother to the children, and so she's put in that particular place. We don't really know. Whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. And he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the hill before the Lord. And so they fell all 7 together and were put to death in the days of the harvest, in the first days and in the beginning of the barley harvest. Now Rizpah, the daughter of this guy, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until the late rains poured on them from heaven, and she did not allow the birds of the air to rest on them by day or the beasts of the field to destroy them by night. And this is a pretty heavy scene, isn't it? You look at that and you say, man, what about these 7 guys? I mean, they get hung for nothing. Except when you look at verse 1, and it says, the Lord said, it's because of Saul. But he doesn't stop there. He says, and his bloodthirsty house. In other words, it's most likely that his sons had a part in the attempt to destroy the Gibeonites. And the Gibeonites recognized it. And so here was David bringing forth the law. The law of Moses was an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. That's the way that justice was. And God had spoken in Deuteronomy chapter 19 that when that occurred, whether it was a king or whether it was a pauper, there was justice was to be justice. Whether it was a king's son or whether it was a man that was in poverty, it didn't matter. That capital punishment, if you murdered someone, then that sword came back and your life was taken for it. And so there's simply the obedience of the law there in Deuteronomy chapter 19 and all of this. And David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of this guy again, why do I keep doing this? The concubine of Saul had done. And then Saul went and took the bone, or David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan his son from the men of Jabesh Gilead who had stolen them from the street of Bethshan, where the Philistines had hung them up after the Philistines had struck down Saul in Gilboa. And David took up the bones of Saul, the bones of Jonathan his son from there. They gathered the bones of the seven who had been hanged, and they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan his son in the country of Benjamin, in the tomb of Kish's father. And so they performed all that the king commanded, and after that God heeded the prayer for the land. And so David gives them a decent burial, and now God heeds the prayer of the land once again. The shedding of innocent blood had hindered that related between him and his people. When the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David and his servants went with him down and fought against the Philistines. And David grew faint. David is older now. And Ishbi-Benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, one of the sons of Goliath that David had slew in his youth, the weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, so the head of his spear was 7.5 pounds. And just to get a feel for that, grab 7.5 pounds of something and try and throw it, let alone throw it with some accuracy. And so this guy had a spear that was that size, who was bearing a new sword, and he thought he could kill David. And apparently he came very close to killing David in this battle, but Abishai came to his aid, struck the Philistine and killed him, and the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall go out no more with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel." And so David now is in that period of life where there's just that period of lesser strength. There's nothing you can do about it. You don't have the strength of a 20-year-old or the strength of a 30-year-old. He's an older man now and liable to get killed in a battle which he would have never thought of being killed in before. And so there's... they say, "Listen, you stay out of the battle. We don't want you killed on a battlefield." And David is really a very rich man here to have men around him who care about him and said, "Listen, we don't need you to defend anymore. We'll defend you. We'll take care of you. We've been recipients of the blessings of your youth and of your strength. But what we treasure about you, David, now, is not your abilities as a soldier. We treasure you and the light that comes out of your life." That's one of the great things, is when a person grows older and the appreciation isn't for necessarily some of the physical things, but the light that comes out of their life because of the presence of the Lord in their life for so many years. And beautiful that these younger men sought to appreciate that in an older man. Now it happened afterwards that there was such a battle with the Philistines at Gob, and then this guy killed Saph, who was one of the sons of the giant. So another son of Goliath was killed. And again there was a battle in Gob with the Philistines where Elhanan killed the brother of Goliath, the Gittite. So a brother of Goliath dies, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam, big. And yet again there was a battle in Gath where there was a man of great stature who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, 24 in number, and he also was born of the giant. And so Goliath had a son, and not only big, but if you're an accountant, it's no good for you. But if you're in battle or something, everything you can get. I mean, these were it. And if you had another digit, I mean, that was a great thing. Well, an accountant, it wouldn't work. Well, that's a poor joke. So I had an intent. So when he defied Israel, Jonathan, the brother of David, killed him. And these four were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. And so we learn here that Goliath had he had four sons. And sometimes when you read the passage where David went and he grabbed into the stream, he grabbed how many stones? He grabbed five stones out of that stream and he put it in his pouch. You can look at that and you can say, oh man, what kind of faith do you have? You only really need one stone. Just put it right in his forehead, baby. I mean, what are you taking five stones for? You think God's going to fail you? And yet it may very well be that he understood the family, and that once he killed that guy, he needed four more stones for the boys that were going to be coming up afterwards. And so he's ready for everything. And then David spoke to the Lord the words of this song on the day when the Lord had delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And so this is David's song of deliverance. Just a beautiful, beautiful song. Again, it's a little difficult for us to find the exact timing of where all of this took place. It's a psalm that's almost identical to Psalm 18. But David might be an older man in the writing of this psalm. And it's a psalm all about the Lord and how the Lord delivered him. You know, it's a wonderful thing when older saints will take the time to write a psalm. And some of you, I'm not in the older category yet. Well, I'm in the older category. I'm not in the oldest category. It's all relative. I'm 18 in my mind. Cool. Where are we here? 2 Samuel chapter 22. But not everyone has the skills to write like David has the skills to write and to write a psalm of deliverance. But it's a beautiful thing when an older saint will stop and impart to the following generations a knowledge of how faithful God has been in their lives. Sometimes you just need to hear that. And you know, those of us who've walked with the Lord for a little while, however long that is, the testimony of our life is a testimony of how faithful He's been to us and to His promises. And there's a lot of people that are coming up behind us in their growth in the Lord. And sometimes they just need to hear that they're going to make it. That's all they need to hear. They just need to hear how faithful God has been to us and that He's going to be faithful in their lives too. And so David takes and he does it in the way that's strong for him, and that is to write a psalm. And David wrote to the Lord this psalm, and he said in verse 2, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, the God of my strength, and Him I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior. You save me from all violence. I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, and so shall I be saved from my enemies." And David here is describing what the Lord had been to him all of his life in the face of his enemies. And you can go through and circle it. And he says, "The Lord is my rock and fortress and strength and shield, salvation, stronghold, refuge, Savior." A lot of things that the Lord is in David's life and that He is in our life. And you notice that word that's repeated over and over again, my, 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 my. What David had between him and the Lord wasn't something that he had learned from a book. He knew the Lord to be these things. Actually, in his life. So he describes the Lord in this way. And he says, because the Lord is all of these things, verse 4, I'll call upon the Lord. Some of us are in a place tonight where you need the Lord to be all of these things. These are all the needs of your life. And the question is, who are you going to call upon tonight? Who are you going to call upon? Going to call on Superman? Going to call on yourself? Going to call on an elected official? Going to call on me? I'm sorry. Your needs are greater than that. And the Lord knows that. And so he says, I will call upon the Lord, who alone is worthy to be praised. And so, how? By calling on him shall I be saved from my enemies. And the Lord, and David knew it to be true of the Lord. And then David describes the depth of difficulty that he'd been through, the kind of trials that he knew the Lord to be all of these things in his life. And not just, you know, on payday, but the day before payday or whatever it might be. And when the waves of death encompassed me, I thought I was going to die at times. The floods of ungodliness made me afraid. I mean, everything going against me, the ungodly looking like they were going to win. You may be here tonight, it just looks like the ungodly are going to win. And you're afraid. And the sorrows of hell or Sheol surrounded me. The snares of death confronted me. I mean, that's the depth of trial that he found himself in. And then in the midst of that, the Lord showed himself strong on David's behalf. And David said, and in my distress, I took out a loan. In my distress, I called upon the Lord and I cried to my God. And he heard my voice from his temple and my cry entered into his ears. And then the earth shook and trembled. I mean, whatever God has to do, yeah, he'll do it. And the foundations of the earth moved and shook because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils and devouring fire from his mouth. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down with darkness under his feet. He rode upon a cherub and flew, and he was seen upon the wings of the wind. And he made darkness canopies around him, dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. From the brightness before him, coals of the fire were kindled. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice, and he sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning bolts, and he vanquished them. Then the channels of the sea were seen. The foundations of the world were uncovered at the rebuke of the Lord, at the blast of the breath of his nostrils. And he sent from above. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too strong for me. And they confronted me in the day of my calamity. But the Lord was my support. And he also brought me out into a broad place, and he delivered me because he delighted in me. That was the heart of God towards David. And that's the heart of God towards us in the Lord. So we're accepted in the Beloved, accepted in Jesus. And then David says the reason that the Lord rewarded him was the Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness. We don't want the Lord rewarding us according to our righteousness. We're under a different covenant. And David was just saying, basically, that he obeyed the Lord. And he obeyed the Lord's word. And the Lord honored that. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his judgments were before me. And as for his statutes, I did not depart from them. I was also blameless before him. And I kept myself from iniquity. So we see different ways that he's talking about obedience. And therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in his eyes. With the merciful, you will show yourself merciful. With the blameless man, you will show yourself blameless. With the pure, you will show yourself pure. And with the devious, you will show yourself shrewd. You will save the humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty, that you may bring them down. And then here's David's confidence in the Lord, knowing that the Lord had done all of this. He said, for you are my lamp, O Lord. The Lord shall enlighten my darkness. For by you I can run against a troop. By my God I can leap over a wall. As for God, his way is perfect. Just takes a little time for that to be manifest. Here he is. He's just letting us know. Just want you to know. Didn't look perfect for a while. Looked a little scary for a while. And now he just wants you to know his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is proven. He is a shield to all who trust in him. For who is God except the Lord? And who is a rock except our God? He's the only rock I see on anywhere on planet Earth. You see any rocks other than him? The Japanese stock exchange? You invest pretty heavily in that, did you? And found that to be pretty slippery rock, wasn't it? You know, or whatever it might be. No, there's no rock other than the Lord. And God is my strength and power, and he makes my way perfect. Feet like the feet of deer, and he sets me on high places, sure footing. And he teaches my hands to make war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. And you have also given me the shield of your salvation and your gentleness, and your gentleness has made me great. You enlarged my path under me so my feet did not slip. I've pursued my enemies and destroyed them. Neither did I turn back again till they were destroyed. And I have destroyed them and wounded them so that they could not rise. They have fallen under my feet, for you have armed me with strength for the battle, and you have subdued under me those who rose against me. You have also given me the necks of my enemies so that I destroyed those who hated me. They looked, but there was none to save, even to the Lord, but he did not answer them. And then I beat them as fine as the dust of the earth, and I trod them like dirt in the streets, and I spread them out. Now David was a man of war, and he was in a lot of wars. And we look at this and we say, gosh, is that? I mean, is this justification for me to, buy a Russian surplus tank of some kind and take the law into my own hands? No, David was involved in a lot of different wars, and this isn't the covenant that we're under here. The Lord had raised him up for that purpose. But what David is describing here, some people can be repulsed by it. But the wars that he was involved in, those were real wars. It wasn't footage of a war. It wasn't putting little plastic men up in the backyard and throwing dirt clods at them. He was in the middle of a war where people were trying to kill him, and his enemies were trying to kill him. And they were trying to kill and put out the lamp of the Lord in his life and trying to bring an end to the things of the Lord for the nation of Israel. So God was very much involved in this, and David was fighting wars for the Lord, and so God had given him the victory. And you have also delivered me from the strivings of my people. You have kept me as the head of the nations. A people whom I have not known shall serve me. The foreigners submit to me. As soon as they hear, they obey me and come frightened from their hideouts. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. Let God be exalted, the rock of my salvation. It is God who avenges me, who subdues the people under me, who delivers me from my enemies. You also lift me above those who rise against me. You have delivered me from the violent man. Therefore, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the Gentiles, and sing praises to your name. He is the tower of salvation to his king and shows mercy to his anointed, to David and his descendants forevermore. Chapter 23, David's last words. And these now are the last words of David. Thus says David, the son of Jesse. And David now is just reflecting on how gracious God was to call him. Thus says the man, speaking of himself, raised up on high. He's thanking God for God's call upon his life. The anointed of the God of Jacob. He's thanking God for the fact that God not only called him, but anointed him for that calling. And the sweet psalmist of Israel. To the very end of David's life, the thing that he was the most thankful for to God was not the crown that God had given to him, but the harp that had been given to him. He was thankful for his relationship. That's what he was thankful for. The crown could have been taken away any time. And I think he would have been happy to go back to a field tending sheep and singing songs to the Lord. That was what he was all about his whole life. That was what was in the innermost part of David. And so David was thankful for that. And he said, "The Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue. The God of Israel said, 'The rock of Israel spoke to me,' and he who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." And so David lays out, related to his own life, and he failed in some of that. He's going to mention that in just another sentence. But these are the characteristics of a leader, and the kind of leader that the Lord is wanting. One who's called, who's raised up, one who's anointed, one who's a listener to God, one who's humble enough to listen to God, one who's a speaker of God's word, as he says there in verse 2. The word of God was on my tongue. He needs to be just in verse 3. He needs to be a man who does what's right no matter what. And the only way he's going to do that is, as we're told at the end of verse 3, he needs to be ruling in the fear of the Lord. And so six beautiful characteristics of a godly leader. And David said concerning this kind of a leader, the fruit of it, the kind of the blessing that it'll be to God's people, and will be like this: he shall be like the light of the morning when the sun rises. Isn't that beautiful? That light of the morning when the sun rises. Now, for those of you who are musicians, you got to get a commentary to have that explained to you. You don't know anything about that. But just something beautiful about that time of the day. I mean, just fresh and beautiful, full of promise and full of hope there. And it's like he'll be like a morning without clouds, like the tender grass springing up out of the earth by clear shining after rain. And so he's talking about all of these things that in that culture were just beautiful things that were available to everyone and still available to us today. And surely as David writes this, he's writing about the Son of David who's to come, the Messiah who is to come. And when Jesus Christ returns and sets up his kingdom, it's going to be like this all of the time. Maranatha, Lord, come quickly. And David said, although my house is not so with God. In other words, David hadn't always been faithful to be what God had called him to be. He hadn't always been faithful to be all of this as a leader. And so he says, although my house is not so with God, yet he has made with me an everlasting covenant, and ordered in all things and secure. And so David said, listen, I've failed. I've been less than what I ought to have been, but God has nevertheless been faithful to me and faithful in his covenant with me. And this is my salvation, and all my desire will he not make it increase. But the sons of rebellion, those who rebel against God, they reject God, shall be as thorns thrust away, because they cannot be taken with hands, but the man who touches them must be armed with iron and the shaft of a spear, and they shall be utterly burned with fire in their place. And so David declares the end of the rebellious, and he says they're like thorns. You try and grab them, you try to do something with them, and you just get stuck. And how did they deal with thorns in those days? They just would take a long object with a shaft at the end of it, and they would just jab it at the ground level and cut it off. Or they would simply burn them right down to the ground. And so that's what David is saying here. That's all that the rebellious are good for. That's the end of the rebellious person. All they're good for time and eternity, is for destruction. Verse 8, these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. This guy right here, and he was also called Adino, the Eznite, because he had killed 800 men at one time. These guys that hung with David, there's 600 of them. And this guy, he had his top three. Joab isn't mentioned. We don't know if it's because David just dropped him because of what he was, or maybe it was just they didn't include Joab because it was obvious he was the commander-in-chief and he was over all of them, but under David. But here's this one guy, one of the top three in David's army, killed 800 men at one time in battle. And after him was Eleazar, one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there for battle and the men of Israel had retreated. And so it's unusual. We don't really read too much about their retreat, but here is a real tough battle situation. And he arose and he attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. I mean, it's tired when it does that. You got to peel it off. And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to plunder. In other words, he wiped out the army. And after him was Shammah. And the Philistines had gathered together into a troop where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. And then the people fled from the Philistines. But he stationed himself in the middle of the field and he defended it and killed the Philistines. And the Lord brought about a great victory. And then three of the 30 chief men went down at harvest time and came to David at the cave of Adullam. And the troop of Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim. And David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. And David said with longing, "Oh, that someone would give me a drink of water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." David was raised in Bethlehem. Here he's in the middle of the battle. The Philistines are holding on to Bethlehem. And he goes, "Oh, man, I'd give anything to have a drink of water from the well there in Bethlehem." Has no idea that these guys are going to go and get it for him. And so they just perked their ears right up. And so these three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines, drew water from the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, took it and brought it to David. And David, when he received it, he wouldn't drink from it, but he poured it out to the Lord. And he said, "Far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is this not the blood of the men who went in jeopardy of their own lives?" And therefore he would not drink it. And these things were done by the three mighty men. And so he valued their loyalty. They took their lives into their own hands. He valued their lives. They had great character. And yet David pours it out. He pours it out before the Lord. And on his part, it shows great character, great self-control, great thoughtfulness, because he didn't want to be partake of anything, enjoying anything that put other lives, the lives of these men, at risk. So he poured it out as an offering to the Lord so that it could be a blessing to everyone. Now Abishai, the brother of Joab, was chief of another three, and he lifted his spear against 300 men and killed them and won a name among these three. And was he not the most honored of three? Therefore he became their captain. However, he did not attain to the first three. And Benaiah was of the son of this guy, the son of a valiant man who had done many deeds. And he killed two lion-like heroes of Moab. Can you imagine? These guys come out and they're the big weapons of Moab. And you look at them and they're like lion men. Wasn't there a And he also went down and killed a lion in the midst of a pit on a snowy day. I mean, you can look at that and go, "Well, what's so big about that?" Who would say that? Who would look at that and say, "What's so big about that?" You ever been in a pit with a lion and had to kill it? And he killed an Egyptian, a spectacular man. And the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, and so he went down to him with a staff, wrestled the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. And these things he did and won a name among three mighty men. And he was more honored than the 30, but he did not attain to the first three. And David appointed him over his guard. And then David lists 30 additional men here to the end of the chapter, all men that were part of the top 30 following these other five. And so they're all listed there. It wouldn't be an honor to them to have me try and pronounce their names, but the Lord includes them. The Lord includes their names. I know I'm going a little bit longer tonight because I'm going to finish tonight, but stay with me because there's one point in the last chapter that I want to bring out. But before we leave David on this particular chapter, it's important to recognize something important about him. He was the kind of a leader that allowed men to be great around him. And not everyone allows that to happen. A lot of people are threatened by that. And David allowed men to become great around him. And the men around David became giant killers in their own right. Why? Because they followed a giant killer. You never read of a single follower of Saul killing a giant, because Saul never killed a giant. And it speaks to us, all of us, in our positions of leadership, whether it be at work or in our neighborhood or in our home, that people around us are watching us and our lives have an influence upon their lives. And so let's be men and women of valor, men and women of faith. These guys that are listed here, these 37 guys that are listed, at one time they were described as a group of men that were in debt, they were in danger, and they were discouraged. And yet by the time God got done with them, they were among the mightiest men in the history of God's people. Don't put any limit on God as it relates to what His call is on your life. Don't do it. Don't do it. You don't know what the Lord is going to do in your life and through your life. And so these men couldn't have believed perhaps at one time in their life that they were going to end up in the position that they were, and yet God was faithful to bring them there. Chapter 24. And again the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he moved David against them, saying, go number Israel and Judah. And so the Lord moves David to number Israel and to number Judah, and he moves him to do so because of his anger against Israel. Now we're told in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 1, that it was Satan who moved or tempted David to go out and number the children of Israel, where we're told, now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. It appears, as you put both of the verses together, that God wants to do two things. Number one, he wants to bring judgment on those men who had joined Absalom in his rebellion against David. And number two, he wants to deal with an issue of pride in David's life. And so he's going to kill two birds with one stone by simply letting Satan tempt David in an area that God knew David was harboring in his heart. And what David was harboring in his heart at this point in time was pride. David is a very old man at this point. There are temptations associated with every period in life, every phase in life. I remember one man who had spoken to Alan Redpath, and Alan Redpath was, I think, 78 years old at the time. They said, does it get any easier, 78? It was a young guy that asked him concerning temptation. And Alan Redpath knew that the young guy was probably talking about the physical end of things. He said, some things get easier, 78, some temptations, but they're just replaced with other temptations. And one of the temptations of age, one of the temptations of experience, one of the temptations that we face in the blessing of the Lord is later in life to trust in His blessings or trust in something else other than Him. And David's heart has shifted here, and now he wants to gauge his strength as a king and the strength of the nation of Israel based upon how many soldiers they have. He's going to number the number of men who are above a certain age that can be in the military and assume that they are strong because of that number, rather than why they are truly strong, and that is the same reason they had always been strong, and that is because of the presence of the Lord in their life. So we look tonight. We're in that place in life where the Lord has blessed us. The one time we knew that He was our strength. He was why we were strong. And now we start to count. We don't count people. We count T-bills. We count other things. And we assume that to be our strength. And that's what we pore over. And that's what we fret over. And that's what we look at. And that's what we assume our strength to be directly proportional to. And it's all pride. And there's a humbling that comes in that, because the Lord isn't getting the honor and the glory that's due His name. We are secure for one reason alone, because He's God. Because He's God. Everything else is wood, hay, and stubble, and will be manifest as such at one point or another. And so the anger of the Lord was aroused. Go and number Israel and Judah. And so the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with them, go now throughout all of the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and count the people, that I may know the number of the people. And Joab, he thought this was kooky, he said to the king, now may the Lord your God add to the people 100-fold more than they are now, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does my lord the king desire this thing? In other words, he's saying, David, numbers don't mean anything. They've never meant anything. Every battle we've been in, we've been outnumbered. Why are numbers a big deal to you now? Oh, boy. And again, we could take it right into our youth. You remember a time in your life sometimes, you're a little bit older, maybe you're still in that place right now. It's easy for you to stay dependent. But you know, it's funny how you can begin, and you don't have two quarters to rub together. That's all you got is the Lord to trust in. He's the only one you can trust in. And all of a sudden, you know, all these other things come in, and the Lord gets moved out. And yet, we can be as confident in Him at the end of our lives as at the beginning, because He's the same at the end of our lives as He was at the beginning. So we tend to move from those things and try to replace Him. Nevertheless, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the captains of the army. And so Joab and the captains of the army went out from the presence of the king to count the people of Israel. And they crossed over the Jordan, and they camped in Or, on the other side of the town, which is in the midst of the ravine of Gad. And they came to Jazer. They came to Gilead, to the land of this place, and they came to Dan, Jan, and around to Sidon, and they came to the stronghold of Tyre, and all the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites, and they went to the south, south Judah, as far as Beersheba. And when they had gone through all of the land, they came to Jerusalem at the end of 9 months and 20 days. It took 9 months and 20 days to do this. And Joab gave the sum of the number of the people to the king, and there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men. And David's heart condemned him after he numbered the people. He realized immediately what he had done. His pride. He was just smote. Lord, I've taken and I'm determining my strength and my confidence and all based upon the number of the people instead of you. And worse for a man like David when the light finally goes on, because he realizes that not only has he done it, but he's been modeling this thing before the entire nation and in effect communicating to them, we're strong because of the size of our army. And he had spent his whole life delivering a different kind of a message, and that was we're strong because of the presence of God in our midst. And so David's heart condemned him after he had numbered the people. And so David said to the Lord, I've sinned greatly in what I've done. But now I pray, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I've done very foolishly. And then David arose in the morning, and the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, go and tell David, thus says the Lord, I offer you three things. Choose one of them for yourself, that I may go to you, that I may do it to you. And so Gad came to David and told him, and he said to him, shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or shall you flee 3 months before your enemies while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days plague in your land? Now consider and see what answer I should take back to him who sent me. Well, gosh, what would you say? They all look pretty bad to me. I think the wise thing is to do what David does. And David says, I think I'll throw myself on the mercy of the Lord. Let him choose one of those three. And David said to Gad, I'm in great distress. This is very difficult for me. Please let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. And so the Lord sent a plague upon Israel from the morning till the appointed time, from Dan to Beersheba, 70,000 men of the people died. And when the angel stretched out his hand over Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the destruction and said to the angel of the who was destroying the people, it's enough, now restrain your hand. And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. That's another name for that. And then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people and said, surely I have sinned and I have done wickedly, but these sheep, what have they done? Let your hand, I pray, be against me and against my house. I am personally convinced that the judgment that God is bringing upon the nation at this point is, again, to deal with David's pride, but also to bring in judgment on those who had joined Absalom in the rebellion against David. And Gad came that day to David and said to him, go up and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And so David, according to the word of Gad, went up as the Lord commanded. And Ornan looked and saw the king and his servants coming toward him. And he went out and he bowed before the king and with his face to the ground. And he said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you, to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be withdrawn from the people. And he said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up whatever seems good to him. Look, here are the oxen for the burnt sacrifice, and the threshing implements, and the yokes of the oxen for wood. All these, O king, I have given to the king. And he said to the king, may the Lord your God accept you. And so here is Ornan, just beautiful, saying, listen, you don't have to pay me for my threshing floor. Take my threshing floor. Take everything I have. Take the animals. Take whatever is happening between you and God, I give it to you as a sacrifice to the Lord. And then the king said to him, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price. Nor will I offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God with that which costs me nothing. He didn't want to offer anything to the Lord that didn't cost him something. He didn't want to offer the burnt offering, which was the offering of total consecration. He didn't want to just take and give an offering that represented his total consecration to the Lord as just a religious activity. He wanted to represent the fact that he was truly and completely consecrated to the Lord. And how did he want to do that? By giving an offering or a sacrifice that cost him something. Salvation is free, but discipleship is going to cost us something. And it's going to cost us continually. I mean, you never outgive God, but there's always going to be that place where the Lord will take and work in our lives, and he will ask for us to give that which costs us something. David didn't want to give something that didn't cost him anything. And so we need to be careful that we don't just worship the Lord and follow him as long as it doesn't cost me something. It's going to cost us something at times. And so David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver, and David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And so the Lord heeded the prayers for the land, and the plague was withdrawn from Israel.